that mind, Muslims in many countries, including Iran, are celebrating Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, a major religious festivity. Muslim countries strongly condemn the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden, slamming the Swedish authorities' green light for the sacrilege. French authorities arrest 150 protesters following angry protests near Paris and in several other cities over the fatal police shooting of a teenager. Hello and welcome, everybody. Muslims across the world, including Iran, are celebrating Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, which falls on the 10th day of the last month of the Muslim lunar calendar. Eid al-Adha is the second major Muslim festival after Eid al-Fitr and a major holiday for a period of 3 to 4 days. It has been already marked in Syria, Turkey, the UAE, and of course Saudi Arabia, where pilgrims from across the globe are performing the Hajj. On this day, people greet their relatives and friends while enjoying festive meals. Those who can afford sacrifice an animal to commemorate Prophet Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his only son Ismail upon a command from God Almighty. Abraham was exempted from performing the command and was offered a ram to sacrifice instead. Earlier, our correspondent Gisumi Shah Ahmadi joined us from Saturday in southern Tehran to tell us more about the congregation prayer offered on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
This is a very important feast for Muslims worldwide and obviously for Muslims living in Iran as well, in all the major holy sites and major mosques in every city across the country. The prayer of this Eid was performed. There is a special prayer that Muslims perform on the major Eids, and of course this Eid was no different. Let's note that Eid al-Adha is a day to share what you have with the poor. Now, there's also a period of about a week to 10 days from Eid al-Adha, which is referred to as the Feast of Sacrifice, to Eid al-Qadir, which is the Day of the Covenant, and that is the day when Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam, was appointed as the successor of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And the period between these two Eids for Iranians, particularly those living in Iran, is a very important period of festivities. As you mentioned, it is marked with visiting relatives, buying new clothes, and basically this is a festive mood, it's a happy time for Muslims living in Iran in particular, and all the Muslims worldwide.
Pakistan has celebrated Eid al-Adha with religious zeal and fervor across the country. They offered special prayers for the progress and prosperity of the country amid a deepening economic crisis. Nasser Kazemi reports from Islamabad.
Like the rest of the Muslim nations, people in Pakistan are celebrating Eid al-Adha, an important religious festival on the Islamic calendar, which marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. Eid al-Adha, also known as the Feast of Sacrifice in the Muslim world, is a joyful and vibrant event marked by sacrificing animals, sharing the meat with family, friends, and the needy. Mosques and public places were packed with people celebrating the auspicious occasion. The day was observed with special prayers and acts of charity that promote a sense of community, unity, and gratitude among people. On this joyful occasion, Muslims commemorate Prophet Ibrahim's submission to the divine order of sacrificing his son.
Eid al-Adha make the day when Prophet Ibrahim was proud to have passed the divine test, obeyed the divine order, and been chosen as a leader and role model for the believers in Islam. Eid al-Adha is the purest expression of worship as well as a sign of sacrifice and surrender to God Almighty.
Days before the auspicious occasion, special livestock markets were established in all cities and towns across the country, where thousands of animals were brought to be sold for the sacrificial event. However, due to the worsening economic situation in the country, there was a large downturn in sales.
This year it is very hard to perform one of the very important religious obligations, that is the ritual of sacrifice, due to skyrocketing inflation and price hikes. The prices of the animals, clothes and shoes have doubled compared to the prices of previous year.
On this Eid, we used to distribute the meat of sacrificial animals among the needy and the poor, who cannot afford to buy meat, and they could join us in the celebrations of this special event.
Besides meeting and greeting, inviting loved ones for the meal and holding barbecue parties are among the main traditions of Eid ul-Adha in Pakistan. Hosting barbecue parties on such holidays has become a growing trend in recent years, where relatives and friends are invited to have fun and enjoy delicious meals prepared from sacrificial meat.
Eid ul-Adha is a festival that not only provides Muslims with the opportunity to reflect on the virtues of sacrifice, obedience and appreciation, but also gives people a great chance to get together, share meals, exchange gifts and extend acts of kindness to each other. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Well, Iran has strongly condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. The foreign ministry spokesman called it provocative, injudicious and unacceptable. The Swedish authorities green light for the sacrilegious act. Nasir Kanani urged the Swedish government to prevent the repeated desecration of Muslim sanctities. Iran's top human rights official also denounced the move, saying it incites violence and hatred. Qazi Gharibabadi dismissed Sweden's claim that preventing the Quran burning gathering would have violated the freedom of speech. He said international law allows for such restrictions to protect the rights of others. Meanwhile, Swedish citizens reacted to the blasphemous act, calling it Islamophobic.
It's part of that perpetual Islamophobia that just keeps growing and growing and growing, and I'm terrified to think where this is going to end.
Freedom of speech is very important, but I think burning a religious book, it's not freedom of speech. It's another thing, it's a provocation.
The sacrilegious act has also drawn condemnations from other Muslim countries. Morocco rejected it as unacceptable and recalled its ambassador to Sweden for an indefinite period. Turkey denounced the insult to the Quran as vile, despicable, and unacceptable. Iraq has said the act is not only racist but also promotes violence and hatred. The Yemeni government said targeting Islamic sanctities are done by the Zionist lobby that has taken control of Europe. Jordan and Saudi Arabia also expressed their vehement condemnations. On Wednesday, a man tore out pages of the Quran's Quran, outside Stockholm's Central Mosque and set some of the pages on fire. Well, joining us for further insight on that story, we have Danazumi Musa, chairman of Nigeria's Council of Ulama, joining us from Abuja. Also, Lebanese journalist Sandos Al-Assad joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Musa. In Abuja, I want to get your thoughts on this event, and also why would Swedish authorities give the green light for such a sacrilegious act to take place? Mr. Musa, are you with us? All right, while we get that figured out, I'm going to redirect that question to Sandos Al-Assad in Beirut. To give us your thoughts on the same question I mentioned. Why would Swedish authorities give the green light and the go-ahead to such a sacrilegious act?
Yes. First, thank you for having me. I believe that the Swedish government is deliberately turning a blind eye and a deaf ear to these actions, these provocative actions and assaults against the not only the Muslims but also against the entire humanity. Because you know that the freedom of speech is restricted in a way or another when it comes to violating the rights and the sanctities of others, especially when you violate a religious script or a religious book such as the Quran, the Torah, or the Bible. This shows reveals the Swedish government double standards. And what I believe definitely that this is definitely just as the Yemeni government described it, that it's linked to the action and the propaganda of the Zionist lobbies in the West. Because, as you know, that the Quran stresses peace, the Quran stresses protecting and respecting human rights. All the lofty values are found and stressed in the Quran. I believe that those the Zionist lobby is working hard on supporting and on inciting those far rights Islamophobes to discredit the sanctity of the Quran in order to provoke the feelings of the Muslims, because as you know that the Muslims have stopped against these violations and these assaults by the Zionists, whether in Palestine, in Yemen, in all over the world. So I believe that this is a war against Islam, against the genuine Islamic teachings that are stressed in the Quran. And that's why the Swedish government won't react. But we see that, you know, the issue of the Iranian diplomat who is meanwhile incarcerated in the Swedish prisons. These are the double standards that the Swedish government knows. If the Swedish government want to put an end to these assaults, it can definitely do this, but they are giving a green light to those because they don't want the values of the Quran to be implemented and to be effectively shown to the West. They want to show the Islam that they want the Takfiri Islam, the Wahhabi Islam, not the genuine Islam. So these actions are done on purpose.
Let's go back to our guest in Abuja, Mr. Musa. If you're with us, please add to what our guest in Beirut just said. She believes that these acts are done on purpose. Also, about the inconsistency we're seeing here when Swedish authorities say that stopping such an act would be a breach of freedom of expression. However, we're seeing that such actions, even by accounts of Swedish citizens, are calling it Islamophobic and will, in fact, incite violence and hatred.
Assalamu alaikum. What actually happened in Sweden is very much unfortunate. And also, it is also the normal and the usual attitude of those who raise war against Allah and His prophets. And also, it is natural for them. They have been doing it outwardly and now inwardly. Therefore, we cannot imagine that they are doing it without the support, without the knowledge of Europe and America. It is a gang, Al-Ahzab, against Islam. It's just a gang against Islam in order to show that if they, for example, if Muslims all over the world react violently, they will turn against, I'm also talking about Muslims, they are not patient, they are not moderate, they are extremists. They will continue to wage this war of calumny against Islam. But it is very good now some authorities, like we had for Iran, it is a clear indication to express the mind of Muslims all over the world. Not only that, it is very good, but the reaction of some authorities for Iran to talk against it, whereby the other Muslims, especially those who are stooges to the West, like Saudis and similar government, they are very silent. They don't care about that. But if, say, for example, that is an attack against the monarchy, they will act. But this is, we are supposed to be facing this one, but Allah indirectly will in turn make other people in Europe to think about why are they burning this Quran. Let me go and look for what is inside the Quran. By doing that, it is another indirect way of propagation of Islam through the approach they took. This negative approach, because they do not understand the unintended consequences of their actions. Their intended consequences is to blaspheme to Muslims and also to provoke Muslims all over the world and also to make Muslims to go violent so that in turn come back to attack Muslims. Therefore, but unfortunately, the unintended positive consequences of their actions, it was in turn their own people will now continue to think about what is Quran, what is inside Quran. Well, if they venture to go and look for it and read for it, Allah, by doing that, Allah will indirectly make them to understand Islam. Some of them may also be converted to Islam.
All right. Thanks a lot. We're going to leave it there. That was Danazumi Musa, chairman of Nigeria's Council of Ulama, joining us from Abuja. And also thanks to Sandos Al-Assad, Lebanese journalist, speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Moving on, French President Emmanuel Macron has called a crisis cabinet meeting after another night of violent protests over the police killing of a teenager. Security forces arrested 150 protesters overnight amid growing anger in the capital and other cities. The Interior Ministry dismissed the unrest as intolerable and slammed those vandalizing public places and setting them on fire. The ministry expressed support for police and castigated, quote, those who did not call for calm. Anger sparked hours after a 17-year-old delivery boy was fatally shot by an officer at a traffic point on Tuesday. Newly released footage shows vehicles burning and riot police gathering along several streets in the Paris suburb of Nanterre. Police also clashed with protesters in Lille and Toulouse, as well as a number of other cities. According to the local prosecutor's office, the teenager was shot after he failed to comply with an order to halt his car at a traffic stop. President Macron has described the incident as, quote, inexplicable and inexcusable. He also pledged justice for the victim and called for calm. A police officer is being investigated for voluntary homicide. French police have been long accused of heavy-handed tactics. A shooting incident outside the United States consulate in the Saudi port city of Jeddah has left two people, including the assailant, dead. American and Saudi officials have confirmed the shooting that took place on Wednesday evening. A Nepalese security guard employed by the consulate was killed in the attack. The U.S. State Department says Saudi forces killed the assailant. Investigations into the attack are underway. Local police say the consulate was closed at the time of the shooting and that no Americans were harmed. The U.S. consulate in Jeddah has been targeted before. In 2016, a suicide bomber blew himself up close to the consulate. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Here at Arabi English Radio, congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice. A happy Eid al-Adha to all of our listeners.
in the limelight.
International activists accused the Western media of hypocrisy in its coverage of death of Titanic explorers compared with other important events happening around the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, on June 22nd, after a search mission lasting over 3 days, a remotely operated underwater vehicle found a debris field containing parts of the Titan submersible about half a kilometer from the wreckage of the RMS Titanic in the North Atlantic Ocean. The discovery, along with declassified sonar detection, confirmed the worst fear of the submarine's catastrophic implosion under pressure and the death of all five passengers on board. Five victims were identified as Stockton Rush, an American businessman and an operator of the vessel; Hamish Harding, a British businessman and explorer; Shahzada Dawood, a Pakistani-British businessman; Soleiman Dawood, son of Dawood; and Paul Henry Nargolet, a French deep-sea explorer. Each of them shelled out $250,000 for the 8-day expedition to observe the wreck of the Titanic, a famous passenger liner that sank in the North Atlantic Ocean in 1912 after striking an iceberg during its maiden voyage. Less than a week before the Titan tragedy, a ship carrying migrants from Libya to Italy capsized in the Mediterranean Sea, sinking off the coast of Greece. More than 100 have already been declared dead, and an estimated 500 more people are missing and presumed dead. The fishing boat Andriana was carrying up to 750 migrants sank in the Ionian Sea around 80 kilometers off the coast of the Peloponnese in Greece on June 14th. Most of the victims were from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, Egypt, and Palestine. The countries where West-backed foreign interventions have spawned the worst humanitarian crises. The chairman of Pakistan's Senate, Muhammad Sadiq Sanjrani, said more than 300 Pakistani nationals have been killed in the tragic incident off the coast of Greece. In another tragedy, as the search for Titan was underway, another boat carrying North African migrants sank off the coast of the Canary Islands in Spain. Of the approximately 60 people aboard, between 35 and 39 people, including a minor, were killed. The two tragic events involving poor migrants from West Asia and South Asia did not grab headlines in the Western mainstream media the way the Titan submersible carrying five wealthy explorers did. Although the two ships carrying migrants were closer to shore compared to the Titan submersible and with a better chance of survival for those on board, rescue efforts were not intense and timely. There was neither breaking news nor minute-by-minute coverage in the mass media about the ship that drowned in the Greek waters, killing at least 100 and with more than 500 still missing. While Western media outlets and social media pages devoted thousands of articles, the potentially worst tragedy in the history of the Mediterranean Sea barely received any significant coverage. The New York Times carried a detailed story with profiles of the five wealthy explorers who died in the Titan incident, with an attention-grabbing headline, "The Five Lives Lost in the Titanic Submersible." A space website said it mourns the loss of Titan submersible's 5 crewmates. Sky said the explorers had concerns before the expedition. NBC News wrote that the youngest victim, 19-year-old Suleiman Dawood, was terrified of the trip, quoting his aunt in Pakistan. None of these mainstream news outlets bothered to speak to the families of the 80 migrants who died or 500 others missing about what they felt about the catastrophic tragedy. Their families or friends were not asked whether they were also terrified before they embarked on the dangerous journey due to the unlivable situation in their home countries. Even less attention was paid to the maritime incident near the Canary Islands, which received less coverage in the European press than the Florida dog show fire, where 5 dogs died around the same time. Unfortunately, just as migrants at the beginning of the last century were unclean for lifeboats and ladies' coats, so today they are unclean for newspaper headlines. The incidents yet again display disparity in media coverage and rescue efforts in saving rich or poor victims at sea, which have become a common phenomenon in recent years, as thousands of people embark on dangerous journeys every year across the Mediterranean Sea. The rescue of the Titanic passengers is remembered for the unequal treatment of the classes. While the first class was composed of ultra-rich bankers, industrialists, and aristocrats, the second class consisted of poor migrants, mainly from Ireland, the UK, Finland, Sweden, Austria, and Syria. Despite the Women and Children First Protocol when boarding lifeboats, most women and children from second class eventually died, while the vast majority of women and children from first class survived. In one of the most infamous examples, a lifeboat with a capacity of 40 people took only 12 of them, among them Cosmo Duff Gordon, his wife and secretary, two other millionaires, and 7 crew. Although they could have accommodated 28 more people during the lowering or picked up several survivors from the sea, which was not an option for 12 aboard. Later, it was revealed that the 7 crew members had received reward money from Duff Gordon. Another notorious example was a lifeboat with Elizabeth J.A. Rothschild and 21 other people, mostly first-class women, with 44 seats available. Among the passengers was a dog of the former. Rothschild could have intervened to save at least one of the dozens of children waiting in line for the boats, but she was more concerned about her Pomeranian. In the end, she and her dog survived, while 52 children from the third class did not. Today, 111 years on, it would be expected that times have changed and that the lives of the rich are not worth more than the lives of the poor, or the lives of dogs more than the lives of children. However, this is not the case, as incidents in the past week proved.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iraq's attack on Iran in the 1980s killed many Iranians with the help of Western-supplied military equipment. The Sardasht chemical attack, which occurred 36 years ago, in which the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was responsible for the killing of some 130 Iranians, may be a piece of history, but the survivors who are suffering until this day deserve justice and have not forgotten this brutal attack. The guilty ones, namely the U.S., France, the U.K., and Netherlands, as concluded by the ICJ, have not been held accountable either. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why countries who preach human rights are guilty of committing the most heinous crimes, like the ones involving the use of chemical weapons. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst, joins us from Verchères, Vermont. Also joining us, Tony Gosling, historian, investigative journalist, who joins us from Bristol. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, Tony Gosling, first, if I may. Tony Gosling, tell us, I'm going to use your researcher skills and put it to the test and ask you about what you remember of this incident that happened 36 years ago in Sardasht, or if not, then what you would stands out in your mind when it comes to the use of chemical weapons during the 8-year imposed war on Iran.
Well, look, chemical weapons, I'm afraid, are completely normal when it comes. Just look at the Vietnam War and the use of the defoliants, the destruction of the ability of the Vietnamese to grow food. That was all just sprayed. Poison was sprayed across forests, across crops, whenever the Americans felt like it. So I don't think it's actually at all fair to even put a principle that the United States may not use chemical weapons. They do it all the time, and they've been doing it right from the start. Because when they decided that they wanted, after the Suez, to take over from the British as one of the main world empires after World War II, they did it in a very, very different fashion. The British Trojan horse was to do with God and Christianity, and they would come with missionaries to persuade people. The Americans really didn't have anything other than the gun, the bomb, and poison in order to intimidate people to come into their empire. So it was a very different character. I think some would say just as bad in many ways. But the Iran-Contra scandal, I think, is the most important thing to tease out of this relationship with Nicaragua. And I mean, for me at the time watching this, it was amazing to see it emerge in the 1980s and 90s as this incredible. Basically, what had happened was the Americans wanted to destroy Nicaragua and other countries around the world, bring them into their empire, but the politicians wouldn't let them. Congress and the House of Representatives wouldn't vote through the money that they needed to destroy these countries and to attack them. And so what they decided to do is set up an enormous multi-billion dollar slush fund led by the military and by the intelligence services, CIA, and other criminal elements, including the mafia and the gangsters. And this organization then went around selling drugs and buying weapons and putting in people like the Contras, which are these far-right paramilitaries, mercenaries, in order to destabilize governments. And none of this was officially part of U.S. policy, but it was all going on. They were trying to pretend that it wasn't happening, pretend, keep it secret, a little bit like, you know, the Israelis do with their nuclear weapons. Let's pretend the world doesn't know we're doing this. Well, anyway, even if the Western public didn't know it was happening, certainly many people in the victim countries knew it was going on, and certainly their intelligence services and their governments knew. So that, for me, is the big takeaway with the Daniel Ortega and Nicaragua, was the link to this, the setting up of these enormous organizations, criminal, mercenary, killer organizations that would provide the money that was necessary for what the American government was not prepared to vote through. Of course, that very few, if any, of these people were ever convicted of the crimes that they committed, the international crimes they committed. In fact, I think it was George Bush Sr. gave them all pardons when he was president. So, sure. You can see there's this kind of unofficial foreign policy that was being forced on countries like this. And, of course, it completely breaks international law.
All right. Let me bring in Christopher Halali into the conversation. Christopher Halali, welcome. We're looking at 36 years since that horrible incident that happened in Sardasht. I'd like to find out from you, obviously, your initial thoughts, but more so, if you can give us a depth as to the how violent and cruel a decision was made by the U.S. in terms, and other countries, I should mention, like the U.K. and France, to have provided these types of weapons, chemical weapons, to Iraq with the intent. I mean, they didn't pull the trigger, but they provided the ammunition for it, so to speak. So give us your thoughts on this, if you can.
Of course. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that the United States, the United Kingdom, and many other partners at that time of Iraq, of Saddam Hussein's government, are liable and have blood on their hands. They are war criminals for the weapons that they gave to the Iraqi army to use against civilians and in combat against Iran in an unprovoked and violent war of aggression. And so one thing to understand is that, you know, if we look at the history, it's very humorous to me that, you know, all those years later, when America said that, you know, we have to go to war, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, all they had to do was open up the Pentagon and look for the receipts, and they would see that they were the ones that had provided these chemical weapons, which are, in international law, weapons of mass destruction. The lives, the amount of people who were not only killed and murdered by these weapons, but also maimed and wounded. And so I think that, you know, there's certainly a lot here in terms of history. And the Iranian people have not forgotten that, and nor should they, because they recognize who supported Saddam Hussein in his aggression against the Islamic Republic and against Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution and the revolution of the masses for justice. So I think, you know, if we're looking at it in the broad scale of time, you know, how many people have suffered and what a just outcome is, it's to see a lot of those war criminals up on trial for what they have done. And not only here, but, you know, as I heard coming into the program, for what they did in Latin America, connecting the struggles, because a lot of the financing, a lot of the weaponry was done at a period of time when a lot of oppressed peoples were fighting for their liberation against imperialism, and the U.S. was supporting any group that they could, legally and illegally and covertly, to have their aims.
All right. Let me ask you another thing here, Christopher Halali, if I may, that shows the depth of knowledge that the U.S. had, because the U.S. has said in its own defense that it did not know that Saddam Hussein was going to use these chemical weapons, even though the U.S. had provided it with these chemical weapons, that it didn't know that it was going to launch some kind of chemical attack. But you have the CIA files proving that the U.S. was responsible. And not only that, you have, and this is just based on a search that anyone can really get, where a retired Air Force colonel, who was a military attaché in Baghdad during the 1980s, who has said that the Iraqis, quote, never told us that they intended to use nerve gas. They didn't have to. We already knew that they would. So that's proof in itself that the U.S. was aware that Iraq was, and its, I guess Saddam Hussein, were going to go through with this.
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. And don't forget, the U.S. government knew that Saddam Hussein was a thug and that Saddam Hussein was a gangster of a type. And so they wanted him to play that role. And Saddam Hussein played off the United States and the Soviet Union against each other through him. And so he would do dealings and do what he could to get concessions out of both. And of course, with the U.S. side, they were fully aware of what he was doing domestically, and they were aware of his expansionist plans. But that aligned with what the United States wanted, which was to see Ayatollah Khomeini brought down, the Islamic Republic brought down. Don't forget, they had just suffered. You remember the speech of Jimmy Carter, you know, Iran is this island of stability, you know, in a more troubled area. Well, that trouble was the Iranian people rising up against the U.S.-backed Shah. And so once that happened, and once the people, you know, wanted Khomeini, wanted the Islamic Revolution, what ended up happening? The U.S. felt that it had a huge loss, similar to that in Vietnam. They had lost this fifth largest army they had put all this money into Iran, which was now in the hands of the revolution and the weaponry and the technology. And so they felt that they wanted payback. And the payback was giving Saddam anything Saddam wanted and his government wanted to ensure that they could do that. They knew fully well. Brzezinski, all of the military brass, all of the top diplomats, they knew, and they write it in their own writings. And what they wanted was for both sides to kill each other, but more so for Iranians to spill their blood, because they had to pay for making America look weak and look bad. And they knew. They knew. The lieutenant colonel, the Air Force commander you were speaking about, it's well known. They didn't have weapons to a gangster with the idea that he's just going to keep it and just say, oh, I have it in case. No, of course he's going to use it. And they knew full well that he was going to use it. They knew full well he was going to use it throughout the conflict. And he did. And so that shows, and the CIA documents prove it, State Department, cables and everything, it all proves that the United States is culpable and morally responsible and should be held in international law because of that, of those chemical weapons, and because it knew that there was a deliberate intent to use those weapons against Iranian people, including civilians.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Tony Gosling, taking a look at that time and taking that piece of history and basically trying to make sure that this is not shelved, we're taking a look not just at that incident that happened 36 years ago, but overall taking a look at that period where the Iraqi imposed war on Iran was executed. There were more than 30 chemical attacks against Iranian non-military targets from what I'm reading here. And it's not just the U.S. that was involved. The U.K., also France, and also the Netherlands, where they provided these chemical weapons. What type of thinking was there in those countries to go ahead with this type of mentality and approach? Now, one of the things that I'm going to say, based on the research done, was that it was because, in terms of Iran's military edge, it was gaining ground against Iraq, and the U.S. figured this would be a way, though they didn't say that outright, obviously. The CIA files revealed that. But what's your take on that type of approach, using chemical weapons in a theater of war?
Well, that's right. This sort of warfare is, it's a very dangerous thing to be doing. But you know what? It's extremely convenient for the West. And I'll tell you a little anecdote, because I was working in Bristol in the CREATE Center, which is a big open plan office, back in the 1990s. And just at the coffee machine, I was just talking about what was going on in the Middle East. And the guy who was running a business just opposite me said, well, you know, we supplied, and he was talking about his business, supplied the precursor chemicals to Iraq to make the chemical weapons with. So that's how, I mean, it wasn't, and people who were, I think, involved in Britain were, Not they weren't actually complicit in the crimes, but they felt bad about what they realized afterwards these chemicals could have been used for. So they were being told that this was for innocuous purpose of some sort. And yet someone somewhere within the British military, or even outside the military, it could be just simply a private military operation of some sort, Almost certainly, though, of course, with the sanction of the Crown and maybe the Joint Chiefs, for example, in the States, or the Joint Forces in Britain, were supplying these. So, I mean, this is just literally from being in Bristol in the 1990s. I picked up this information from, and you know, he was saying, well, you know, it was us. You know, we were involved in all this, and of course, the reason is one of the purposes here is that the British and the Americans get to test these weapons without actually getting their hands dirty. So they're giving them to somebody else. They're manipulating Saddam, in this case, into thinking that he's going to make he's going to be able to keep it all secret. He's going to be able to make some kind of war winning opportunity using these chemical weapons, but that no one will find out that they ever came from Britain. Well, this is the trouble, of course, with much of this Western policy, is that they're doing it on the assumption of secrecy. Now, look, we're living in the internet age. We were in the 1990s too. And what happens is people either, maybe this is one of the reasons they want to bring in artificial intelligence into targeting, as they're doing in Ukraine, is because the artificial intelligence may well tell no tales. What happens is when human individuals are involved in these atrocities and breaking international law, they have a guilty conscience. Many of them, anyway, or most of them, have a conscience, and they think to themselves, well, afterwards, that wasn't the right thing to do. And if some investigator comes along and asks them, even if it's just many years after, were you involved in this, they may be very happy to talk about it, to get it off their conscience. And so I can tell you almost certainly that some of the precursors for those chemical weapons probably came from Bristol in England, and if there was an investigation, you may even find where exactly they were made. But that's why they do it. They want to test these weapons out, and they also want to dirty the hands of people who, you know, like it's like the shaking hand of Tony Blair. When he comes and shakes your hand, that means that you're for the scaffold. That means you're about to be executed, and you're going to be let go. And they've been manipulating smaller countries like that for many years, trying to bring them into their confidence and then destroying them.
All right. Piece of fact coming out of that imposed war in Iran, I'd like to break it up a little bit more with you, Christopher Hilali. It was reported that the United States learned through satellite imagery at the time that Iran was about to gain a major strategic advantage on the ground over the Iraqi forces, and at that time U.S. Intelligence officials, they actually conveyed the locations of the Iranian troops to Iraq, fully aware that Saddam Hussein's military was going to use these chemical weapons, which included sarin, based on the report that we have, which is a lethal nerve agent. I'd like to find out from you, when you have that type of approach by the U.S., how that is actually then repeated when it comes to the Iraq War 1 and 2, when it comes to other theaters of war that the U.S. has been involved in, and also most recently where the U.S. Was contemplating giving approval for depleted uranium to Ukraine to be used in the, from the tanks that they have. Why is it that the U.S. feels like it has to subscribe to chemical weapons or even depleted uranium, which they used in the Iraq War also, in order to achieve their so-called goals?
Absolutely, it must be stated, without a doubt, that the United States not only provides intelligence, as you mentioned, satellite imagery, troop movements, and locations for where, there are buildups of forces from the quote-unquote enemy that they provide to their local forces on the ground, be it, in this case, to Saddam's army, or whether it be in Yugoslavia or even contemporary, giving locations of Russian positions to Ukrainians to use the HIMARS and other artillery that they have and their drones and airstrikes to target Russian forces. So this is known throughout, recent history that the United States does this. It's part of their warfighting strategy, is to give this important intelligence to the armies carrying out their wills. And that's what really makes these wars proxy wars, but even more so now, because of the armaments and things like that, much more dangerous and higher level than even proxy wars. In going back to Iraq, the Iraqi imposed war on Iran, Iranians had the advantage at one point in the war, and actually quite a few points in the war, but especially because this was an unprovoked war on the Iranian people, on the Iranian nation. And so the willpower to fight back. And of course, the United States tried to create, stoke sectarianism, ethnic tensions, religious tensions, you know, down in Bandar Abbas, you know, where you have a lot of Arabs who many of them are Sunni. Of course, you have in the reports, we're going to, you know, so they're going to be natural allies of the Ba'athist army because Saddam is, you know, Arab, he's Sunni. And so, but that didn't happen. In fact, the opposite happened. They were loyal and patriotic, and they believed that this was an attack on the entire Iranian nation. And so they fought even harder to preserve the nation. And so, of course, with this advantage, the United States gave a lot of the locations, a lot of the troop movements to the Iraqi military with state-of-the-art technology in order for Iraq not only to target those forces, but as a previous colleague here mentioned, to use and to test these chemical weapons and to see their accuracy, to see their potency and their lethality. And so they had all that data. That data came off the ground and went into the reports, many of them top secret, many of them will never see. But they're there, and they knew that this was going to happen, and they wanted it to happen. We know that this war imposed on Iran was meant to dislodge the Islamic Revolution because it was such a profound threat to the United States and to its regional partners. And so, of course, with this in mind, there's full knowledge of what was going to transpire.
Okay.
And it should be stated again that the United States has done this and continues to do it and will do it into the future, providing locations, providing geospatial imagery, satellite imagery, everything like that to ensure that its forces or its proxies have the advantage in fighting. And of course, in using these kinds of weapons. The depleted uranium was used throughout the previous decades. And that, of course, has caused long-term damage and health defects and environmental damage. And they knew that.
And the images that we've been showing in this program are testament to not only the brutality and the side effects that these unfortunate victims suffered during that time, but how this has been now passed on generation after generation. Yet the U.S. still keeps the sanctions, Tony Gosling, in place to this day, where there are people who are still suffering here inside of Iran. Why doesn't the U.S. get some relief in that way for Iranians who are suffering from this brutal event that took place, of which you know, so many people actually not only died from it, but to this day are suffering from it?
Well, I think it's because it's suffering from a brutal meltdown in internal democracy. And what you ended up with is a criminal clique that the last thing they want to do is to admit their many, many sins and faults. That's why they won't get rid of these sanctions. And unless there is a complete shift in government in the United States, which looks unlikely at the moment, you're going to, I'm afraid, have these criminals protecting themselves
sure.
rather than running the country.
Thank
but
you.
Look, you're talking about the deaths over in Iran or Iraq, but in Britain, I mean, this is how brutal the British were. They were actually getting volunteer
Thank
soldiers
for that.
From the British Army. The British Army. And they were testing these gases.
Thank you for that. We're unfortunately fresh out of time. I do apologize, Tony. Tony Gosling there, historian, investigative journalist. Sorry to cut you short there from Bristol. Christopher Hilali, researcher and political analyst from Berkshire, Vermont. Thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikava Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran
via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakati.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam economized when it came to spending upon himself. He lived a rather ascetic, simple lifestyle. But His Eminence Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spent a great abundant amount of wealth on the poor and the needy people amongst the Muslims. And it is precisely because of this unequaled and unparalleled generosity that Imam al-Jawad has been called and titled Al-Jawad, the Generous. This surname was the most particular and famous surname of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, to the extent that he was well known and famous for it amongst the people.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.